This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 16, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE. They're intended for your own personal use and any other use of this audio with the podcast without the express written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated is prohibited. Now let's go ahead and take a look at some things that have happened in this week as we headed towards the first corporate filing deadline when we're getting all those extensions ready to run or finishing up the corporate returns. And the first one we're going to take a look at here is a case of Mains versus Commissioner, 144 TC number 8. And what this one deals with is the importance of a state's definition and whether the federal courts are bound by the state definition of something for federal tax purposes. Generally, we have a federal system, as you're aware, and certain issues are reserved to the federal government, certain are reserved to the state government for purposes of rulings on law. Generally, the nature of property is determined by state law rather than federal law, and the federal tax law applies on top of that. What we're looking at here is a case of some refunds that were provided by the state of New York. In this particular case, the state of New York enacted some programs. And the three programs that were involved in this were the QZEZ Real Property Tax Credit, the EZ Investment Credit, and the EZ Wage Credit. Now, these credits were all credits against New York State income tax. And the law provided that these credits were either wholly or partially refundable. And if the credits were refunded, that the taxpayer would treat that as an overpayment of state income taxes. The reason why that's important is because the question becomes, is this taxable income? As you may be aware, generally, when you have a refund of state income taxes, it's only a taxable item for federal tax purposes if, under the tax benefit rule, you had previously gotten a benefit from deducting the taxes. So that sets up today's case, which looks at these credits. Now, the first credit, the real property tax credit, was limited by a taxpayer's previous payments of property taxes on the property in question. The other two credits, the investment credit and the wage credit, were limited by nothing. You just qualified for a certain credit. If that credit was in excess of your New York State income tax, you could elect to either carry the credit forward or, taking a reduction in the amount of the credit, get it refunded to you currently. So the question became, these particular taxpayers, Mains, in 1 year, they had some tax wiped out by the credits and then refunded. And in the other 2 years, they had other New York State non-refundable credits that totally wiped out their income tax. In no year had they claimed a deduction for New York State income taxes. The position they took, therefore, was when they got these New York State income tax refunds, was that because they had never claimed a deduction for New York State income taxes, they did not have to claim this as income for federal tax purposes. The IRS disagreed with that ruling, saying, no, this looks like generic Section 61, income from any source, however derived. But Maine said, but remember, state law governs property rights. And since state law governs property rights, the federal courts have to respect the fact that New York has called this a state tax refund. So the case went before the tax court based on this concept. What's the nature of these refundable state credits if the state has labeled any payments or any overpayments for refunds as a refund of state income taxes? Well, basically, the court agreed with the IRS rule. In fact, the funny part is they end up quoting Abraham Lincoln, using Lincoln's example that if, as according to the tax court, if New York called a tail a leg, we'd have to conclude that a dog has five legs in New York as a matter of federal law, borrowing an Abe Lincolnism. Even actually cites back to Abe Lincoln, to a book about Abe Lincoln, and even tells you where to find this online in archive.org on the internet. So if you're interested in researching Lincoln, you can go ahead and follow that up from the tax court. The tax court concludes that while generally federal law works at property, the states cannot basically change economic reality. Merely calling what is income something that wouldn't be income does not make it not income unless that label comports with reality. In this case, they found, in fact, this was simply an accession to wealth on the part of the taxpayer, since there were no limits imposed based on previous deduction of state income taxes. This was not a refund of state taxes because there was no state tax paid. So the court concluded, on the first credit, the real property credit. That one would be governed to the extent that it was refundable. If it reduced your state income taxes, there's no issue. You just have no state income tax deduction. Therefore, there's no problem there. But if you get a refund of it, it would be taxable to the extent you had previously obtained a deduction or obtained a tax benefit from the deduction of the property taxes that were used to basically justify the credit. If you had somehow paid the property taxes but received no tax deduction for those years, then, as a matter of law, it would not be taxable income. On the other two credits, which were not limited by anything, again, if they offset New York State income tax, there's no issue there. You get no deduction for the New York State income tax offset, but you have no income. However, to the extent you received a refund, that's a simple accession to wealth. And the court went one step further. What if, instead of taking the refund, I just elect to carry those credits forward? Well, the court found that because the taxpayer had the right to ask for the money to be paid, that was effectively constructive receipt. And because of constructive receipt, the taxpayer had to, essentially, go ahead and, under the constructive receipt doctrine, pick it up as income, even though the taxpayer had not actually received the cash. The fact the taxpayer had a right to receive cash in lieu of having the credit going forward meant that the taxpayer had to go ahead and recognize that income currently. So bottom line, federal law looks to the substance of a payment, not a label a state may try to put on it. And secondly, if you have an option to take the refund in a case like this, it's going to be taxable to you regardless of whether or not you take the refund. Next up, we're going to take a look at the IRS's issuance of a foreclosure and cancellation of debt audit technique guide. This is the real property foreclosure and cancellation of debt audit technique guide that was issued this week. As you may remember, in the latter part of the last decade, we had a bit of a real estate crisis, and a number of taxpayers ended up with issues regarding foreclosures of property, including their homes, and cancellation of debt in various issues. As we've also discussed multiple times on this podcast, the lending agencies don't necessarily get the issuance of the 1099-C correctly. In fact, we just had that problem come up last week, if you remember, where we had a wrong issue 1099-C by FEMA. So now our problem is the IRS has auditors out there hitting this problem. So the National Office has issued an audit technique guide. It's about a 70-plus page guide in PDF format that talks agents through what the rules are for cancellation of debt and basically the issues for foreclosures, cancellation of debt, as well as talks the agents through how to examine returns that have this on it. Now, it has a number of interesting discussions. There's a useful discussion there about the difference between recourse and non-recourse debt, which is a huge issue with regard to the question of how you handle a foreclosure transaction. There's also the issuance of the timing of cancellation of debt, and even some guidance from the national office about how an agent can determine that if, in fact, the publication takes position that if a lender is not pursuing collection activities that are required under state law, not taking the steps to pursue collection activities, you will deem effectively that they have canceled the debt at that point. So that was something to tie to foreclosures. It also has a nice little, as I say, example of the difference between non-recourse and recourse foreclosure that's really useful if you've not gone through that or have that problem. Has a brief discussion of the issue of state law and anti-deficiency rules on this, which, by the way, is huge. It has a table in the materials of what the IRS has identified as 12 states where an anti-deficiency statute can have an impact either on whether a debt is recourse or non-recourse or on whether there has been cancellation of debt. Some of these anti-deficiency provisions do not prevent a lender from getting a deficiency judgment, but state that if the lender goes the route of a non-judicial foreclosure, that is normally a trustee sale or something similar, that the lender gives up the right to collect the difference. As the IRS points out, if that is the case, the minute they have given up the right to collect the difference, you have a cancellation of debt event. However, if the anti-deficiency statute provides that a lender can never get a deficiency judgment regardless of what they do, then effectively you would have a non-recourse loan. The guide specifically tells agents to consult with local counsel's office to discuss the impact of state law because this is going to vary from state to state. That's good advice for CPAs who run into this problem. Clients should be seeking local counsel, now probably not from the IRS District Counsel's office, but local counsel from an attorney who's skilled in understanding the state law. After you communicate to them, you're looking at the lender's rights, not necessarily what the lender will do, but what the lender could do in order to determine the federal tax law impact. So this audit technique guide is really useful for those of you who run into this problem and have a client that is stuck with a problem property that gets foreclosed. Let's move on next to a case dealing with conservation easement deductions. The IRS has continued to go after this. We've seen a number of cases regarding the special rule of a transfer by a taxpayer of a conservation easement to get that into being qualified real property and therefore be able to take the deduction. Now, basically, under the law, generally we cannot get a charitable contribution if we give a partial interest in property, but there is a special rule for certain real estate interests. And in this particular case, we are looking to a right granted in perpetuity for a conservation easement. The question became Balsam Mountain Investments. What happened in this case, the taxpayer gave that right to a trust that was a charitable organization, gave a right to preserve area to, you know, have a conservation easement issued on the area in perpetuity. However, the agreement said that Balsam could change the boundaries of the area that was granted as long as it didn't vary more than 5% of the property, so no more than 5% was involved, and any property substituted had to be connected to the property that was already together. It had to be contiguous, and contiguous by a wide berth, not just a little narrow 1 foot strip of land that goes for the next, for let's say a mile, and then connects up to the other part of the property. But rather, it has to be a wide berth. The IRS said, hey, this violates the rule in the tax court ruling in the Belk case. In the Belk case, which was 140 TC number 1 that was supplemented by TC memo 2013-154 and affirmed by the Fourth Circuit, the IRS had held that if a taxpayer retained a right to substitute land, even if the charity had to approve it, even if it had to be equivalent and the charity had to act in the charity's own best interest when approving such a transfer, that was not a qualified conservation easement. Balsam claimed, well, we don't have the right to do the whole thing. We just have this very limited right, and therefore we're different from Belk. The tax court found, no, you're not. They say you must grant a specific property in perpetuity. In this case, we only know that you've granted an area, any part of which could be swapped out as long as you don't swap out more than 5%. The fact that you reserve that 5% change the boundary rule meant you get no deduction whatsoever. Therefore, the tax court is telegraphing very clearly that they are going to strictly enforce the fact that you must grant it in perpetuity, and anything that the client tries to do to say, well, just in case I need to do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to reserve this, is probably going to end up putting the deduction at risk, or in the tax court's view, simply killing the deduction. So it is key, if you have taxpayers that have been involved in such transactions, to understand the problems and the issues and how the tax court is enforcing this right now. Next up, the IRS issued Notice 2015-18. This is on the new ABLE accounts. You may recall in the new tax law, we established a special tax advantage account that we're able to use for various disabled taxpayers who are relatively young when disabled that allows us to set up an account where the income will not be taxed and where if we use those funds to pay for the qualified disability expenses of that qualified beneficiary, we're going to be able to treat none of that distribution as taxable income. This was, of course, somewhat important because this gives us kind of a simplified special needs trust. Now, the catch is, though, 529 ABLE accounts have to be established by the states in question. So it must be established under state law, or a state must go ahead and grant the right to another state to manage a program for them. The problem right now, of course, is that Congress passed this law at the end of December. We are now in many states have a legislature that, unlike Congress, does not meet year-round, often that meets early in the year, and frankly is going to leave in a couple of months and not come back for another year. The problem is these states need enabling legislation passed, but right now the details have not been fleshed out. We don't have proposed regulations, temporary regulations, or even until Notice 2015-18, a notice from the IRS describing how these rules would work or how we're going to handle some of the details that are going to need to be in place when the states set up this program. In this case, the IRS has decided to issue that guidance. The IRS states in Notice 2015-18 that it is their intent to allow states to adopt these things now, and that the IRS will basically state, subject to a couple of pieces of guidance that are in this ruling, that they expect to have transition rules that, to the extent a state adopts a program that doesn't qualify with the rules that are finally adopted by the IRS, there'll be a transition period where you will not lose qualification on the account. But the IRS does make clear a couple of issues that probably will be significant to people setting up the account and should be significant to the state legislatures adopting it. They note that these plans were designed kind of on the basis of the qualified tuition programs under 529. But they note there are some significant differences they expect in the guidance they'll issue. One thing they note they expect will be different is that the owner of the 529A account will be the designated beneficiary of the account. That is who must be the owner of the account. Other parties put into the account, but the beneficiary is the owner. Now, in some cases, the disability may be such that the beneficiary will not have signature authority over the account. The IRS provides as well that the person who does not have signature authority over the account may neither have nor acquire a beneficial interest in the account, and they must administer the account for the benefit of the qualified designated beneficiary. So they have basically a fiduciary duty to the beneficiary, and they cannot get anything from the account. They cannot be a successor to it if the person passes away and the state doesn't take the funds from the account. That signatory is not going to be able to get funds out of the account. The idea from the IRS's perspective being to get rid of any incentive to not use it for a beneficiary, but use this as kind of some long-term tax advantage savings account for the benefit of the signatory of the account. So signatories will have to be truly independent. Finally, we're going to take a look. We're going to take a look here at the issues of a payment to an accommodation partner and whether or not that is subject to self-employment tax. This is the case of Kai versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memo 2015-42. Now, this guy had been approached by a buddy that he met in Harvard who happened to be married to his cousin. This buddy was promoting tax shelters. Now, the tax shelters he wanted to promote required a partnership. And these partners, of course, to have a partnership, you need to find somebody to be a partner. So Buddy wanted this guy to agree to be partners with these people. He would be allocated tons of income that would allow these people coming in and buying the partnership to be allocated these huge losses, at least under the design of the shelter. We'll not talk about the fact that the shelter basically had other problems and probably didn't work. Well, almost certainly doesn't work. That's a whole nother set of litigation going on. But he would get that. His income would therefore, this phantom income he'd be allocated, because of course we're giving people phantom deductions. They didn't really want to lose money. They wanted to just get a deduction. Would be offset by other deductions that would be created for Mr. Kai. Now, that transaction is not part of this for right now. However, Mr. Kai received various payments in addition to participating in these partnerships. The one in question is a $2 million payment that he received right towards the end of this. And in this case, he received the $2 million payment from them. And from the perspective of the shelter, this was a sort of bonus for his participation. And how do we know that? Because when Mr. Kai got it, he called and talked to the then current CFO of the organization. She explained that it was a bonus and that, yes, as they had in the past with $100,000 payments they had made to him, they'd be issuing a 1099 miscellaneous to him, and that basically this was going to be income to him as kind of a consulting fee. Therefore, she told him he should consult with his tax accountant regarding how to handle this. Now, Mr. Kai, of course, took the money, and when it came time to do his return, he told his CPA about the $2 million, but he didn't tell his CPA about the fact that he had been told it was going to be self-employment income. The CPA, who was looking into this, was asked to look into this, called. The old CFO was gone. The new CFO had come in. He discussed with the new CFO the nature of this payment. Now, he kind of got a vague description of what's going on, but he decided that it seemed to him like, well, it was in the K-1s had been issued to Mr. Kai, and therefore there would be nothing for Mr. Kai to report. He was not aware that Mr. Kai had received a 1099, nor was he aware of the conversation where it was told that this would be treated as earned income. Well, the IRS, of course, disagreed and came after him. Now, Mr. Kai argued that first this was a return of capital. The tax court decided he had no proof that he had ever put any real capital into any of this stuff. He agreed that there were no records to support this. He also agreed that, well, you know, basically, yeah, we don't really know what this is, and I can't prove anything because it was so messed up and so mixed up. So the court said, well, rejecting that. He then claimed, of all things, it was a gift from his buddy. The court said, well, there's no evidence whatsoever it's a gift. Look, they told you they were considering it payment to you, a bonus for participation. So don't give us that gift story. Finally, he said, well, if it's taxable, it can't be self-employment income because I didn't really do anything. The court said, sorry, guy, you were in the regular conduct of a trader business. Your participation in these partnerships was crucial to that business operating. You got involved in it to make money. And finally, taxpayer, you decided that you wanted to be in this thing because you wanted to effectively, you know, make money from earnings. And while you may have assigned some rights to people and set up organizations, you did that. You are in control. It is self-employment earned income. Pay up on it. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 16th, 2015. Go ahead. If you want to, you can find links to everything I discussed here today on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also visit there during the week as we post updates as things occur. Be sure to join us next week when we'll talk again about what's happened in the area of federal taxes.